Start tonight with Psalm 53. And my introductory comment I'm going to spend a long time on because it seems to me important. This psalm, check it for yourself when it comes up, is an impassioned reflection on the folly and corruption of those who do not acknowledge God. And, second key thing in it, a statement of faith that Yahweh, the God of history, the God of Moses, the God of the Exodus, the God that is experienced in the history of Israel, that's what we mean by Yahweh, that named one, is on the side of the oppressed. The two very important notions. So let's take the first. An impassioned reflection on the folly and corruption of those who do not acknowledge God. And allow me a bit of philosophy with you, and I'll just try a few thoughts. I would have liked to have had a more interaction with you on this, but obviously it can't happen here, so I'll just give one-way traffic. I'll just give you some thoughts. We might discuss them later. What does it mean to acknowledge God? Obviously, there's going to be a whole lot of different opinions on this. The email that was plastered on the internet by the Al-Qaeda people who blew up all those people in Iraq this morning or whatever time, have God is beneficent, God is great, there is one God, Allah. Are they acknowledging God? I would say undoubtedly they're not. They would say they are. So we've got a problem already. Would the people who are using religion of any kind, Christianity too, for power and prestige and control, are they acknowledging God when they use God's name? No, I would say. And they might look at my life and say, you're not acknowledging. You know what I mean? So we're in an area of conflict and different opinions. And none of us will get it absolutely right. So I'd like to start with what I mean by it, as best I can offer it to you, and see if it makes sense to you. I go back to two fundamental experiences that seem to me to be part of the human race, part of my experience, but I think they're part of everyone's experience. The first, actually, is one of those intuitive leaps that Thomas Aquinas makes when he has the five famous proofs for the existence of God. Proofs better not be taken out of context. It's not proof like empirical proof in science. So it's a tested way of thinking that life makes sense of. And he calls it a contingency. I think it's his most powerful leap of intuition and insight. That I experience myself, do you do it? Ask yourselves this, as not the center of my own being and not the source of who I am. Clearly I wasn't once, so I can't be self-explanatory. And I don't mean we just go back to parents in time and say, well, I wouldn't be if my parents hadn't have loved each other and I'm a result of that love. That's true, but that isn't my point now. My point is that this very second, now, I exist, but I don't have to exist. I need not exist, but I'm factually existing, obviously, and so are you. But when I look at everything about you that you are, it doesn't add up to existing. Your life, my life, contingent being everywhere, the mind intuits that there's more to reality than this flux of time and space and life and birth and death, and that there's a source. Now, every culture pretty well has that idea. When, however, this is the problem, when we start to put concepts into this sense, this intuitive leap, this something that you look at the stars or look at a storm or look into a baby's eyes or, you know, millions of experiences you've all had, when you're having this experience, you then ask, well, what is this mystery? I'll use that word. What is this presence? What is this source? And we happen to have the word God for it, which is a good one, but it doesn't matter the word, really, a lot. And then once we start loading into there, as you'd agree, I'm sure, we clutter it up because we necessarily have to. We've got all kinds of choices then. We And all we do, as all the philosophers tell us this, and the mystics, and they're obviously all right, we choose from alternate categories or contrary categories, we choose the one that faces us towards the our experience and not away from it. So when we say, for example, God is personal or impersonal, there's a choice. Now, both are wrong, because when I say personal, I can only mean you as a person, me as a person. I've got a whole lot of thoughts about a person, and they're not going to be right of God, of course, because God doesn't fit into our little categories. But the problem is, if I say God is impersonal, I'm facing the wrong way. When I say God is personal, I'm opening myself to a mystery that somehow engages me and is there's intelligence and will and whatever, you know, we're still using. So we're just facing into there. When we say, is God beautiful or ugly? Is God loving or hating? Is God, you know, all the variants we can have. We choose the one that engages us and fits our experience, and then the fruit of that facing ends up being incredible sanctity in whatever culture you're in. People become more gentle, more loving, more wise, more truthful, more forgiving, more everything in that direction. In this direction, people don't. So, you know, that's what we're learning from. So we kind of face that way. That's one of our intuitions, I think, about God. This contingent reality that I am dependent ultimately, and you can't have one thing dependent on something else that's contingent and that depending on something else that's contingent. I know I've read a little bit about chaos theory and all that, and I don't understand a lot of it, so I don't want to pretend I've got the latest in physics. But that's the kind of run of the argument that I find fairly satisfactory, to be quite honest, and could say more about, but I won't now. The second insight that I think accounts for this is more profound in a way and more simple, and that is the sense of the sacred, the sense of mystery. People sense a grove of trees, and something touches them there in that grove. And it's more than just trees, it's a presence. People have it in a river or a mountain, a volcanic mountain perhaps, or in the star-studded sky, or in a storm, or in love, in sexual love. The world is kind of sensed as sacramental, sacred, here am I using the best words I've got for it, and mysterious, but there's an interconnection there that we sense. And that's why people worship, is that a good word? It's a funny word, it's so overloaded. That's why people are in awe of, and the more we explore that, the more wonderful things are, and the less likely we are to treat people or events in a blunt, controlling, flat way. We sense that the world has depth. So, heaven knows why I said all that, but so acknowledging God is somehow acknowledging these simple experiences that we all have. And then, and I've said this already, pardon me, I'll just say it again briefly, we all have to keep watching, because as soon as we put words on this God, as soon as we make any attempt to lock God in or define God, and look at the word, define, we're in a hell of a mess. We make awful errors, and then you get all the religious wars and all the stupidities that go on, and you, I'm sure, recognize, you probably see more in the Dalai Lama or Mahatma Gandhi or Mandela, whatever you see there, or am I saying I see more in the Dalai Lama and Mahatma Gandhi and than I see in, I was going to say a hell of a lot, but that wouldn't fit, of people who claim they follow Jesus and their lives are just dreadful in my view, you know. So, and I think you're all like that. So it's not a denominational thing we're talking about, it's something very profound. And of course, Jesus is wonderful, and I won't go on to talk about him yet. That wouldn't be appropriate. To acknowledge God then is seen by a person's life. Acknowledge, coming to the knowledge of, and knowing in the Bible means intimacy. So acknowledging God isn't using the words even. And you probably find, I've found, some people who would see themselves as atheistic, they would define themselves as atheistic, because they are actually rejecting all that they associate with the word God. And invariably, I have found when I've had discussions with such people, and I don't have them that frequently, but I've had plenty, when they finish their little bit, I say, well, if that's what God is, I'm rejecting it too, so we've got a lot in common. You know, that's their conceptuals of God is just dreadful and has to be rejected. But they haven't actually been exposed to another conception of God that is more liberating and so on. So that'll do for that. This man, anyhow, and through the Bible we're going to find that everybody, but let's go back pre-Jesus. I'm often saying it to you, but don't expect the biblical authors, with all their beauty and their prayer and their openness to grace and what they said must be pretty inspired, because people kept copying it and repeating it and singing it, so it must have meant something to a lot of people, and we're still doing it, for heaven's sake. So let's presume there's something wonderful being said there. It's still very, very limited and sometimes very distorted, because they lived in the 6th century BC culture that was up there on the mountains of Samaria or somewhere. What expect, for heaven's sake? Just as what I'm saying now, if St. Thomas Aquinas were here, or if John of the Cross were here, he'd probably say, look, you could have said that in about a minute, and you might have done better just to go into some mystical prayer and invite the others in with you and just shut up because you're talking too much. I don't know what he would have said, but I wouldn't have minded if he said that, because he's probably right. But so we're just... Okay. The second wonderful thing in this psalm and in all the psalms, and now we're into something really profound, is that this Yahweh, their God, is on the side of the oppressed. I think you'd have to say that in ancient history, that's unique to Judaism or to Israelism and then Judaism. It's this, because everybody... I was at a wedding the other night in Sydney, and someone bailed me up, as one of my priest friends said, when you go to a wedding and we go to wedding receptions, which I haven't been to, I used to go on uni but haven't been for a long time, at a wedding reception people come at you like Messerschmitts. It's true. It was a good image, really. Because you've given a homily that engages people maybe for the first time for a long time, because they haven't been churched. And then they start getting, and then they want to know about celibacy. I don't know why that's happened. I suppose that seems to be the key issue. So you're there defending your celibacy and admitting your mistakes too, you know, it's really like a public confession. But they're kind of getting into all this, and then they want to know about this and that and that, and then that one finishes and this one comes, or no one finishes, someone butts in, and why am I saying all that? I don't know. Yeah, God, she talked about a higher power. I said, oh, for God's sake, higher power, what the hell are you talking about? I'm talking about God, you know, higher. What's higher mean? What's lower mean? What, you know, I could see that she's saying something, but our language is really pretty bizarre. Higher power does sound to me like somebody up there who's infinitely powerful and we're down here. Well, if he's up there and we're down here, we're not talking about God. Because you can't have God plus anything. God must be that of which we are all expressions. Has to be. Flowers, me, you. So you can't have God without you. You can, but you know what I'm trying to get at? Once you're there, you're an expression of God. So God is found in and out, but not up or over. Okay, that'll do. But everyone sees God as the God of the mountain, the God of the Pharaoh, the God of the king, the God of the military, the God of the rich, the God of the successful, the God of the Pentagon, for God's sake, the God of the victorious war. Whole lot of ratbaggery. Judaism sees at its best, because they were slaves. We were slaves, and God took us and made us his own. We were a wandering Aramean was our father. You know, like, we weren't the famous, the great. And if only Judaism stayed with that, well, Jesus was the best looking Jew you could ever find, and he knew this is true. God is the God of the oppressed. So this psalm will say that again. Just about every psalm says it. And it's a beautiful concept. It doesn't mean God isn't the God of everybody, but it means God is the one who actually listens, even though the general isn't and the parliament isn't and the people up there aren't. God isn't up there. God is at the heart of everybody's life and is listening to the oppressed. Enough, because we haven't got to the psalm yet. If we fail to acknowledge, our psalm will go on to say, the true God will create our own. And my heavens, that's obvious. Your God will be the stock exchange or the taxpayers. They seem to be very important people, the taxpayers. What about the citizens? What about the people of the country who haven't got a job and mightn't be paying tax, but they're growing vegetables and they're giving us their kids, and you know what I mean? Taxpayers. Or the other fray, I don't want to go into it. All the different, the people have shares, the shareholders seem to be, that's great, the shareholders are better off because now Qantas has made $700 billion or something, I don't know what it is, and they're sacking everybody with their left hand, and the shareholders are getting better, so that looks good, the stock exchange, great, we're all cheering. What about the people who've lost their job? What about the people who go to the bank with their little few dollars? No, they're not of interest particularly, it's the share. So, if we acknowledge God, we'll create our own if we don't. And our own will be the bottom line or something. In this case, in the same of this psalm, the God is the untrammeled power exercised by those who show no concern for the poor. They're their own God. Your ego could be your God. Self-adulatory stuff. Verse 7 is a plea that Yahweh will restore his people, composed, so it would seem, by someone who's living in exile. Is it the exile from Samaria, the destruction of Samaria in 721? Could be. And that exile never ended till Second World War period or whenever the people came back into the 40s. Or is it people from the destruction of Jerusalem over in Babylon or Egypt or somewhere else where they escaped to? Another interesting thing about the psalm we're about to read is that Psalm 14 is almost identical with this psalm. Go back and look at it if you like, and you'll see that. Verses 5 and 6 have a different slant. But an interesting thing is when Psalm 14 uses Yahweh throughout, this psalm uses God. And my suggestion, nothing more to you, is that it might be that the Psalm 14 was made in the Northern Kingdom, and then this is the adaptation for the Jewish temple of that psalm. And in Judea, they were very fond of calling God Yahweh. Whereas you've probably heard of the Eloist and the Yahwist. If you haven't, I won't go into it now. But the two streams that come into the building up of the Torah. Eloists in the north and Yahwists in Jerusalem. So we might be onto something there.